New technologies have great potential to support education. However, bringing innovation to the school, university, learner, and teacher is a challenging endeavor. Today we discuss how new technologies change the way people think and learn by looking at games, project-based learning, and data analytics. This is MediaVox. I'm Daniel Spiegel, assistant professor at the Department of Media Technology at Malmo University, and by my side are David Williamson Schaefer and Morten Misfeldt. Welcome.
Thanks. First of all, let me just also say it's a pleasure to do this, and thank you for both hosting us here in Malmo and giving us this opportunity to chat and make that chat available to others. I'm David Williamson Schaefer. I'm the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Learning Science at the University of Wisconsin and a game scientist at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research.
Yeah, and well, also thank you very much for having us here. So I'm Morten Misfeldt. I'm professor in mathematics, education, and technology at Aalborg University in Copenhagen.
So I wanted to ask you guys, since you represent the United States and Denmark, which I think kind of covers a lot of the world and the educational approaches, what are the challenges that education faces today? Any thoughts about that?
I think main challenges that we see is having schooling take 21st century skills seriously. How are we actually teaching the skills that are needed in our society, skills like collaboration, innovation, and so on? This is one main challenge. Another main challenge is, I think, the digitalization of the school endeavor, that schooling is met by digitalization and it transforms teaching, schooling, and it hasn't really found its form yet. I mean, 1 week we trusted all in MOOCs, massive open online things that will like solve education for everyone. The next week we think that new digital tools will allow students to be more creative and so on. Next week, we think teacher administration software will make sure that everybody learns enough on time and so on. And all these movements are pushing schooling, and I'm quite convinced that it is moving schooling forward, but there will be, I mean, it's going back and forth right now. So the digitalization and 21st century skills would be my answers to that question.
Yeah, I think both of those things are right. And what we're seeing is a real time of transformation and turmoil, and those are always really difficult. In addition to the fact that we have to be teaching new things in new ways, we have to figure out how to incorporate new technologies as the technologies themselves are changing. And then along with that, we have to figure out what the role of the teacher is going to be. But there's been a lot of focus in the last 10 years of research in our collective field about technology, on how to think about skills and collaboration and many of the kind of the content side of things. There's another piece, which is that most students are going through lots of social and emotional changes as well. We tend to not necessarily think about how technology impacts that in the context of school. Clearly, it does with social media and other things. But it's also important that teachers continue to play a role in students' development, and figuring out how that interfaces with technology, I think we've lagged sorely behind. And then on top of all of that, kind of in addition to all of that mix and mess, there's also just the problem of equity. We face that in the United States in a big way. We see it in terms of racial disparities and other disparities in terms of student outcomes. But when you cross all those things together, we're really trying to solve a whole bunch of problems that are interrelated, where we don't actually understand all of the how all of the moving parts work. And the moving parts are changing at the same time. So it's I think, a really interesting and really challenging moment in the educational and technological world and where those intersect.
Both of you had done many different approaches and investigated kind of new ways for learning and teaching. Can you talk a little bit about that from some of the tools that Morten has made to kind of the long history you have in using games as part of things?
Some of the things that we have done in Denmark recently is working with how technology for teachers can both make sure that teaching and learning occurs in according to, you know, the national plans and so on, while not decoupling the teacher of the decisions made in the classroom. So how can we use technology and analytics to increase the teacher's agency in class rather than have them be like run by the system or following systematic procedures laid out by technology. So we've created this piece of software where you set up the goals for your own lessons, like objectives, and relate them to a national curriculum, thereby making sure that you meet the standards and so on, but also making very apparent to everyone what are we aiming at here and now, us in this classroom. So I would say the approach that I am taking right now is an approach where we try to use digital technology to increase teachers' performativity and agency in the classroom.
And I think that this idea of the role of teachers is becoming more and more apparent in the field of educational technology. If you look over the history of educational technology over the last 20 years, I mean, you could look back further too. We just don't think of educational technology that used things before computers as being educational technology, although it is. But if you look at the last 20 years, there's been a lot of work done trying to figure out how we can use technology to make it possible for kids to learn in new ways. So in my own work, for example, we've looked at building virtual internships. So we know that kids need 21st century skills. We know that they need to learn to think about real problems. They need to learn to think about problems that are complex and don't have solutions that you can bubble in on a multiple choice test. And so we can build simulations where they work as architects and engineers and lawyers and doctors. Right? But one of the things that we're realizing more and more is that in that push, a lot of educational technologies have really been designed either in a one-size-fits-all way. Everybody does the same internship or everybody uses the same tool or technology. Or they're completely open. So there are tools that are available that provide very little guidance for teachers. We've kind of hit both ends of the spectrum. Either there's a lot of guidance and prescription as to how the thing should be used, or it's the Wild West and the teacher has to figure out everything for him or herself. And what we're seeing, I think, is a need to be able to provide structure and guidance and support for how something can be used in the curriculum well, but also make it possible for teachers to customize or localize things for their particular students and the needs of their particular students. One of the things Morten and I have been talking about and working on a lot lately is this idea that when you develop highly immersive, really powerful and engaging games and simulations, they're incredibly complex. There's lots of moving parts that have to interact in order to create the illusion that you're really an engineer or really an architect or really a space explorer or whatever the game is. And it's hard, not only hard for teachers to reprogram those from a technical point of view, but from a pedagogical point of view. As you start to change things, all of these connections break down. And so being really thoughtful about how it is that teachers can interact with an immersive and engaging simulation and yet make it customized for their students, make it so that they can adjust the reading level, add activities, take activities out without kind of destroying the student's sense that they're engaged in a world where things are exciting and challenging and different. That seems like it's a really important frontier right now in thinking about learning.
Let's talk a little bit specifically about, you know, briefly your own projects. I mean, I first met Morten when he came to visit me at another university, and I was really kind of fascinated by kind of the tools that you kind of developed to help, you know, students learn about math. Maybe you could just give us a little quick rundown on that.
Particularly in mathematics, I mean, computers are, in a sense, calculators. This means that with computers, you have much more mathematical muscles than you would have without, right? Given almost any problem, you can put it into a mathematical piece of software and it can help you solve it. And that's a huge advantage for all mathematical performances in our world. However, it is also a challenge to education, and that challenge I have worked with. How do we use these softwares in ways where you maintain the learning of mathematics while using these muscles? So a quick example. If you teach word problems in order to have the students become very good in algebra, then it might not be helpful to give them a super powerful computer algebra system that allows you to do all the math with the computer and just ask. So basically, you just put the word problem into the computer and get an answer, and then you give the answers to the teacher. So these kind of challenges call for, I would say, projects and more creative work in the math class? How do we not only do this word problem, but actually engage in genuine mathematical work with these tools? And it also calls for very concrete solutions on when not to use the tools, but especially the meaningful way to use strong digital tools in mathematics I've worked with. And the approach we have taken has been to have teachers develop meaningful scenarios for their students, where students engage in training, working with the specific concepts, and then do a project that is related to these mathematical concepts. So it's, in a sense, a role-playing game, for instance, where you act as you are working on a factory doing math games, and then you develop like a little board game with some mathematical tools, and you use these tools in an explorative and meaningful way.
I think this is the point Mort makes is a really good one, and it's a really general point, which is up until the advent of computers that we had ready access to. So I'm looking around the table here, and every one of us has a computer in our pocket that is many times more powerful than the computer that took astronauts to the moon in the 1960s. Up until that point, students really only carried around one computer, and it was the one that was between their ears. There was only one thing that they could do that could manipulate information and go from a problem to a solution. And now we live in a world where that kind of power is at our fingertips all the time. And the problem is that we have an education system, a whole view of what school means, of what learning means, that's designed around the idea that you have to kind of load in all of these programs into this one computer that you have. We have to essentially build the computer over 18 years so that students can then use it to do things that matter later on. And once you change that, assumption, it fundamentally turns the process of education upside down. And of course, the challenge is that we know that teachers tend to teach the way their favorite teacher taught, and parents tend to think about education as being the same thing that they saw when they were in school. And yet we're faced with a world where more and more those things are not designed for the world that that we live in. We constantly ask the question, what do students need to know? And in some sense, what we really need to ask is, what do students need to be able to do? What are the kinds of problems that they need to be able to solve? And that looks very different than what our typical curriculum looks like right now. So the computers are essentially creating this challenge, and I think they play a really central role in solving it as well, or need to.
Let's kind of move on a little bit to data-informed technologies for learning, like learning analytics, assessment, privacy, and ethics, because I mean, we see, you know, with today's systems that we can mine data about how students learn, how teachers teach, and how schools perform, but it raises a lot of challenges in terms of how best to use that to get to the heart of the problem, which is, you know, what do students need to know and how do they translate that knowledge into their own kind of thought about learning or thoughts about learning?
I think that data science is in a really exciting and really dangerous place right now. It's really exciting because we have a lot more information about what people do that we capture sometimes for free and sometimes for not that much work. We can, when students are working on a computer or on their phone, it can record lots of information about who they talked with, what resources they looked at, what choices they made, what design steps they took. Instead of just seeing a final product that we assess, you know, if you have your students write their essays in Google Docs, for example, you can actually go back and see the history of all the edits that they made along the way and assess their writing process and not just their final product. So that's really exciting. But there are two big challenges, I think, that we face. One is questions of privacy and ethics. And it's very clear that as a society, as a world, we have not grappled with that as well as we will need to, because you know, basic functions of democracy and free speech and free thought get threatened when everything that you do is potentially recorded. You know, we get very excited. I have a thermostat now that can keep track of everything that I do and figure out how to make my home, you know, regulated, have its heat regulated to reduce cost and save energy. Unfortunately, it also means that somebody out there on the internet can know exactly when I'm home and when I'm not and what it is that I'm doing. So there's lots of privacy issues that we need to deal with. The other challenge, I think, is that data is not the same thing as information, and information is not the same thing as knowledge. And it's very tempting to use the power of computers to take lots and lots of data that we generate and find patterns. And essentially, if you have enough data, there is going to be some pattern that you will find that appears to be significant. There'll be some relationship. And whether that relationship is in fact useful for student learning or for anything else becomes suspect. An easy way to think about this problem is we know lots about how people play chess. Cognitive scientists like chess, and so they've studied it very carefully, right? It turns out, not surprisingly, that really expert chess players move much faster than novices do. When you're learning to play chess, you have to think a lot about each move. And when you've played a lot, especially early in the game, you can move really quickly because you can analyze the board quickly and you can make good decisions. So that's an easy pattern to see. However, just knowing that and telling a novice to move faster or judging their performance by how fast they move their pieces is the worst way to teach somebody how to play chess. That's a very simple example, but I think writ large, we see this problem right now in data analytics. We need to be very smart about how we use the mass of data that we collect to produce information that we can use knowledgeably to help students and teachers accomplish the things that they need to accomplish better.
Yeah, how does that relate to some of the work that you've done with teachers, Morten? Because I think this, you know, issue of data analytics is great for performance, but it's very hard to design it to support creativity. Being a teacher involves a lot of kind of creative practices in order to meet the needs of individuals and the class as a whole.
Yes, especially for teachers, but I would say in general, when professionalism meets the data science and you now have more and more data about student learning or health or whatever, and you have to engage professionally with authority and ethical, meaningful behavior, there are some difficulties. I mean, you very easy become like a medium for decision made by data science, and then you are not a teacher anymore. You're not a teacher with your full person, right? I heard the word data literacy, and I think actually that word is important for all professionals and especially teachers. You need to be able to understand, make decisions based on complex sets of data. So that's one thing, and I think also the data system, the data infrastructure that we create, it should help this professionalism, and it should reflect this professionalism. And this means that these data structures has to be locally malleable and changeable and so on. So you have to, as a professional, be able to participate in developing the data infrastructure that you are going to work with as a professional. So that, I think that's and we are definitely not there yet. We do a lot of work with data that tells people to move faster instead of to think, or to in the chess example, or to do specific things instead of think about what they do. Right.
And I think there's an important piece of this kind of professional way of thinking about data, which comes from my own. So my background is as somebody who uses both what we call quantitative methods, so methods that use data and crunch numbers, and also qualitative methods, so methods that look at what people are really doing, that observe in the field, that actually talk to people and ask them what they're doing and why, that try and understand how they're thinking and not just look at the surface features. I think that one of the important lessons for data science right now is that we need to move from just doing quantitative analysis and what we call learning analytics to something that looks much more like a quantitative ethnography that takes the numbers and actually the technical term is grounds them, actually has those numbers touch back down to the things that people are really doing, that base the sophisticated statistical analyses on understanding of what it is that those numbers mean and why it is that people are moving their eyes in the way that they're moving their eyes, why it is that they're asking questions with more or less frequency, why it is that they're scanning documents rather than reading them deeply, all of the kinds of information that analytics collect. One really important way that data analysis gets grounded in this sense, kind of touched back with reality, is to actually show the analytics to the people who were involved in the first place. involve teachers in the creation of the analytic tools. And also, one of the things we've seen in our work is, just to step back for a second, so one of the things we do is collect data about how students work collaboratively to solve problems. And then we create a model of the way they make connections between ideas, the way they mobilize skills and knowledge and decision-making in order to solve a problem. And we show that as a network for that the teachers can see how the student's understanding gets connected up over time. And when we created that visualization, one of the things that teachers do is turn around and show that to the students, because that becomes a way for the students to understand what they're doing well and what they're doing poorly. And if you have these kinds of numerical, quantitative, data analytic representations that actually mean enough to the students and to the teachers that they can use them, then that's a good sign that you're capturing something that's useful, that goes beyond just telling people to move faster.
That kind of leads me to the next question. What I've been thinking about is, how do we design these types of systems to allow, you know, for creativity, for daydreaming, for procrastination, and maybe more importantly, for an educational scenario, some type of like productive failure? Because most of the analytic systems we see are very performance, you know, based or process based, but they don't look so much at allowing students to refine kind of deeper creative problem solving skills. Any thoughts and ideas about how we could do that?
Well, I guess it's difficult to, maybe not impossible, but it will be difficult to predict whether or not I'm about to get a marvelous idea right now, right? And that's, in a sense, what you are asking. And I think this has to do with data literacy in terms of not allowing ourselves to become a medium for the data infrastructure that we have put up. I mean, we should be there as persons, and we should allow students to be there as persons trying to explore their full potential. So it's hard for me to say this in a positive way, but we should be careful not to have the data infrastructure that we develop become the goal that we aim for. This is one point. I guess there's another point in how to develop meaningful analytics that can actually push education in meaningful directions. That's a good plan as well. But say we ended up doing super analytics that could show that people are collaborating in a very, very fancy way. This could be a problem as well, right? If we were only targeting the collaboration and not, you know, the work or reflection or individual learning or whatever, right?
I think that's right, but I also think that one of the things that we are starting to see and we'll see more of is that we have a kind of cultural mythology, if you will, that expertise is a kind of monolithic, uniform thing, that there's one kind of expert engineer, there's one kind of expert doctor, there's one kind of expert lawyer. Even just observing in the world, it's pretty clearly not true. But from a teaching point of view, we sort of hold up one model. It comes out of this idea that all of our tests and all of our subjects had one right answer. There really is only one right answer on your math test, and there's usually only one right answer on your biology test. If you move away from the idea that we're trying to capture and then repeat the correct answers, what we start to see is that there are actually multiple forms of expertise. One of the really positive things about data science is that we can actually start to measure those. We can actually see that different people who we would call experts, who arrive at good solutions, can arrive at them through different paths, because now we can actually watch the path that they took. So they may get to different solutions, all of which are good. They may get to the same solution, but take different pathways to get there. And so we can turn that question, sort of what does the path to success look like, into an empirical question, and we can make it a question not of what the path to success is, but what are the multiple paths to success? And a way of thinking about that, right, is that there may be lots of different things that people can do in order to get to a good outcome. And there also may be some things that they can do that are really not going to take them in a very good direction. And so instead of saying you're either on the right path or you're not, we can say, well, you're somewhere in the range of reasonable things to be doing to solve this problem still. Or you're actually going in a really bad direction and we should be doing something to try and, to steer you around. So I think that's kind of the positive side of data analytics and of the notion that we have a much richer understanding of what students are doing, is that we can think about what their problem solving and thinking process looks like rather than just the product. And we can see very clearly that, in fact, there are, you know, more, there's more than one path. There's not an infinite number of paths. I mean, what we see, at least in the kinds of, you know, worlds that we create. So we have high school and college students designing kidney dialysis membranes and robotic exoskeletons for rescue workers to pull people out of collapsed buildings, right? Not everybody solves the problem the same way, but there aren't 1,000 different solutions, you know, good ways to solve the problem. There are a few reasonably well-worn pathways, and you can see when somebody's on one of those. And some of them involve different kinds of experimentation and productive failure. Some of them don't, and that's fine.
Well, great. That really answers kind of my question about, you know, constructive feedback from learning analytics, that it offers, you know, opportunities for, you know, groups of students to see the many paths to success and try them out, you know, and see which one works for them and for their team. So that leads a little bit to kind of a different type of question as we get to the end, is that a lot of your research, both of you have focused on kind of embodied and immersive learning experiences. You think that this is a good future for learning, to engage students and to give them complex problems that they can learn from?
Well, to be honest, I actually think that learning has always been embodied and immersive. We just embody kids in a classroom where they're sitting in a chair, and we immerse them in a world where they're playing the role of a student. So a way of thinking about school is it's a gigantic game. And in fact, every student knows that. Right? Every teacher knows that, right? We're all playing a game. My role as a student is as a student, and there are certain things I do to play the game well. The problem is it's a lousy game. It's a lousy game because it's not much fun for many students, although some students do enjoy it. And it doesn't do a very good job of preparing kids for the real world. So we already teach them in an embodied and an immersive way. We just need to immerse them in experiences that are going to be both more interesting and engaging and also better connected with the things that they're going to do in the future.
But also, I think this, the game of schooling, you don't just leave that game if you engage in, for instance, a role play or some out-of-school activities. So I think in terms of our understanding of teaching and learning in schools, we need to acknowledge the coexistence of a, for instance, an immersive online role play that you do in order to get certain experiences, and while simultaneously acting as teacher and student somehow. And the way, for instance, teachers move role between being, in a sense, in-game, acting as, for instance, managers of a laboratory or something, and then in school acting as teachers and pedagogy, raising and teaching, right? So this is a challenge for our understanding of teaching situations, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and I think another challenge is that obviously, what modern technologies are making possible is a much wider range of kinds of immersion. You can be immersed in many different kinds of worlds that weren't possible before. So many of the ideas that people are talking about, project-based learning and personalized learning and those kinds of things, John Dewey was talking about those 100 years ago. The problem was that John Dewey didn't have the right tools to be able to create personalized learning in the same way that we can today. So I think the opportunities are really tremendous. I do think that one of the challenges that we face as a field is understanding the distinction between immersion as fun and immersion as an opportunity for intellectual and emotional growth and transformation. And there's a lot of interest in the idea that school should, you know, immersive environments are fun, and that school can therefore be fun for kids, and fun is good because fun gets you engaged, and all those things are true. But again, if you go back, 100 years ago, one of the things we know is that if you just do stuff that's fun, it's not necessarily educative. What happens is you get interested and motivated in something, and then you run into an obstacle. And it's in the overcoming of those obstacles, it's in the motivation to overcome an obstacle in some way, that you actually learn something from the experience. Seymour Papert described this as hard fun. John Dewey talked about this again 100 years ago. I think that one of the challenges is figuring out how to create these kinds of environments that are compelling and engaging and hard, and that get students and kids and adults in training and professionals to engage with things that are going to be difficult and meaningful and that will help transform them in positive ways and prepare them for future experiences that will be difficult and engaging and transformative.
Great. I have one last question, but now it's not such an easy question. So it seems so difficult to innovate education when you know, formal education, when you compare it to informal education, you compare it to, you know, the fact that you can almost learn anything on the internet. Any kind of parting thoughts about how, as researchers and people involved, both in policy as well, could, you know, hints about how we can make, you know, education a little bit more innovative so it can catch up to the rest of society?
Yeah, well, I think the reason that it's difficult is that we are simultaneously changing the means and the ends of education, right? So we bring new experiences, new technologies that allows you to more efficient learn, but simultaneously we put new demands on our youth in order to have 21st century skills. So we change the goal and the means in the same time, and that is always difficult. And that, therefore, there's a tendency to every innovation kind of washes back. So that's like a very, very strong conservatism in the system, and that might be good, right? Because you could end in very weird places if you simultaneously changes the goal and the means in like a spiraling, just way off World of Warcraft school, right? So there's something good about the institutionalized conservatism in schooling. However, thinking about how to then innovate would be, I mean, you have to acknowledge broadly the need for instance, 21st century skills, or the need for using digital tools in mathematics. And then you have to work with, I think, the stuff that you can work with, the design parameters, the assessment tools, and the teaching materials, and of course, with engaged teachers. But I think the main reason for the conservatism, in my view, is the combination of changing goals and means.
So I hear quite a version of that question often. I usually get it in the form of, you know, kids spend all these hours playing video games. You know, if we could make school as engaging as video games, they could finish high school in one day or something like that. I think in some ways it's a really unfair comparison, in the following sense, right? You know, the most popular movie out. You know, if a few million people see a movie, it's a blockbuster. If 10 million people see it, it's off the charts. School is something that every kid does. And the likelihood that you're going to make any movie, any game, any app, any YouTube video that every single person will like in the same way that they like their favorite movie or TV show or anything else is a really high bar to meet. So I think that the universality of school or schooling is the root of that problem. It's not so much its formalization. It's that we expect it to be universal and that we have not done a good job historically of customizing school experiences for kids. And again, that's partly technological, right? If I put 30 kids in a classroom, and I put 30 kids in a classroom because the economics are such that I can't afford to pay more than one adult per 30 kids, right? We need everybody else earning money to provide the warehousing for kids, right, at the rate of 30 to 1. And if all we have is textbooks and we have a limited number of them, there's only so much personalization that I can do. So I think that as we develop more immersive tools for learning, and as we make it possible for teachers to do a better job of fitting those to the needs of their individual students in groups or even their individual students individually, it's possible for students to get for teachers to do a better job of helping match students with things that are going to be compelling for them and yet still take them in directions that they need to go. There's, of course, one other thing which has to do with Morton's means. So that's the means side, right? There's also an ends piece, which is we actually, in a sense, don't design schools for kids. We design schools for society. Right? We send kids to school Yes, because it's good for them, and that's why as a parent I want my child to go to school. But I want your children to go to school because I want them to grow up and participate in society in a way that's constructive for me. So we have a set of ends for – school has a goal that isn't really the same as the goal that more informal learning environments have. And again, it's not – that doesn't have to do with its formality. It has to do with the sort of social and technological realities of school. So I think those are some of the reasons why school will never be the same as a video game. It will never be as engaging as your favorite book. It will never be as great as your favorite movie. But I think it can do a lot better job of providing multiple ways for more students, and particularly students who are currently very disenfranchised in school, to get the things out of it that they need and that society needs for them to have in order for it to be a more engaging and more productive experience.
Great. I want to thank both of you for coming to Malmö and participating in our Media Vox.